Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're less than a year until midterm elections. From redistricting, the pandemic, tenured departures, a lot is still taking shape and at stake. The latest development, Congressman Devin Nunes, a 10-term Republican representing the Central Valley, announced his retirement effective the end of this year. The high-ranking Republican is a close ally of former President Trump and will be leaving government for the private sector, running Trump's new social media company, which leaves a gaping competitive hole as Democrats and Republicans fight for control in the midterm elections. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon joins us with the bigger picture. Hey, Nicole.
Hi.
Well, the announcement was abrupt and a shock to many, but within the political world, was this a surprise announcement?
You know, I think it was. Nunes is a very well-known Republican. He's one of former President Donald Trump's fiercest defenders. And they're still close. So this move to take over Trump's new media company, I think, is one that makes sense for Nunes. But it's still a little surprising because he has been such a fixture in the Republican caucus. He was positioned to chair another powerful committee, the Ways and Means Committee, in 2022 if Republicans do take back the House.
He's rounding out nearly two decades in Congress representing the Central Valley. Remind us about his trajectory in politics.
Yeah, I talked with Professor Thomas Holyoke at Fresno State University yesterday, and he said that, you know, Nunes, from the moment he entered Congress, has been sort of a Republican Party warrior. In his earlier years, he took on a lot of local issues like water, things that really mattered to Central Valley constituents. Here's Professor Holyoke.
During the Obama administration, I mean, Devin Nunes really took on the Department of the Interior about cutbacks on water from the federal system to valley farmers. You know, he's part of the organization that put up all those signs around the valley. You know, the Congress created drought. Now, when Donald Trump became president and when Republicans became the majority in Congress, Nunes kind of shifted. He became much more part of the Washington establishment, I would say.
Yeah. And keep going, Nicole.
No, I was just going to say he chaired the House Intelligence Committee beginning in 2015. That's the committee that investigated reports that Russia tried to influence the 2016 election, sort of the beginning of these very controversial, scandal-plagued sort of investigations of the Trump administration. And, you know, there is some chatter that Nunes may have faced a tougher fight next year because of redistricting, but I'm not sure that played a role here. Those lines are not finished yet. Even if his district got more competitive, he may have been able to keep that seat. He's very well known and well loved in his district, or he could have run in a different district that would have been better for him. But, you know, all of that's beside the point now.
Yeah, going back to that soundbite we heard about pushing back against the Obama administration with water, I mean, it's important to remember Nunes is a former dairy farmer. He's from Tulare. Mm-hmm. What does leaving such a high-ranking position in elected office and essentially like his hometown, home region, for the private sector signal?
You know, I think it signals where Nunes feels the influence of the GOP is going. Trump is no longer in Washington. Nunes has had a long career in Congress, and I guess he feels he doesn't need to be in Washington anymore to remain relevant. According to the Trump Media and Technology Group, it's building its own social network. You know, this is after Trump was banned from Twitter, suspended from Facebook, and many of other sites. And then conservative lawmakers and pundits have also claimed that big tech censors their views. There has been research that's shown that's not true, that these networks amplify their voices. And this company also says it's building a streaming platform for news and entertainment and documentaries. So Nunes will be leading this company. It's very interesting. It's an interesting move because he has gone after tech and media companies. He has not tweeted in over a year. You know, this was sort of the mass exodus of conservatives from Twitter to Parler, which is now a sort of folded network, but social network. But, you know, you might also remember that in 2019, Nunes filed a bunch of defamation lawsuits against news organizations, McClatchy, CNN, and he even sued Twitter over two parody accounts that made fun of him. So now he'll be leading this sort of alternative tech and media company.
Given he was popular among voters, though, he's a 10-term Republican, an incumbent, and also within the Republican Party, a high-ranking Republican official within Congress. Can you remind us or explain, he had mass fundraising appeal. Why was he so popular among his constituents?
I mean, again, he's always been sort of a party stalwart. He really went after Democrats, and he represented a conservative district in the Central Valley. Like you said, he was able to raise money from all over, and not just, you know, his local constituents, but national Republicans, because he was so loyal to President Trump. And now that loyalty is being rewarded with this job leading Trump's new venture.
With that, I just think about complications with a runoff election butting up against midterm elections and with different district maps. Those are still taking shape. I mean, this sounds kind of costly and potentially confusing, not only for taxpayers, but also for voters.
Yeah, it could be pretty confusing, because how this will work in the immediate future is when Nunes resigns, the governor will call a special election. He will have to do that. There is some leeway if someone resigns after the filing deadline, but that's not till March. So this special election will happen. It will be under the current district lines. And we can expect that to take place probably early next year. I will say special elections are not that uncommon. We've had 3 or 4 in the last year for the legislature. So then there will be, you know, the primary in June and then the general election in November for a completely different map that we don't even know what it looks like yet.
Yeah, that really isn't a lot of time. Are you hearing any chatter who might compete for this open seat in the special election, either Democrat or Republican?
Sure. Yeah. A few state lawmakers, Assemblywoman Melissa Hurtado and Assemblyman Devin Mathis, both said on Twitter yesterday that they were considering, but they were waiting to look at the lines. A few other names of, you know, Fresno County supervisors and councilmen have been thrown out as potentials to run in the special election.
Congressman Nunes is the latest, but not the only congressman in California or congressmember in California who's retiring. We also heard about Congresswoman Jackie Speier, a Democrat, announced her retirement. Any word about who could potentially fill her Bay Area district?
Yeah, she has actually come out yesterday and endorsed Assemblyman Kevin Mullen, who, you know, their family has kind of a history. His father was in the legislature. So I'm not sure. I don't know if this. Yeah. OK, sorry. I'm getting confused with special. We're talking about special elections. So this is all for next year.
Yes,
so it just shows
midterms.
You how confusing it really is.
It really is. I mean, you're talking about your March, June and July of 2020 or November of 2022. There's a lot happening.
And these are like dominoes. So now there will be sort of this scramble to, you know, people will announce to run for Kevin Mullen's assembly seat. And that's just how it goes when these vacancies and sort of moves happen within the political world.
Yeah, you will be a very busy person, Nicole. Going from Congressmember Nunes, heading north in the San Joaquin Valley is Josh Harder's seat, a Democrat representing the Modesto area in the Central Valley, a hotly competitive district, and also in limbo as redistricting is taking place. What can you tell us about this district?
Yeah, again, I'm not sure I want to get too much into the lines because they're not concrete yet. They haven't been voted on. But an earlier draft showed that his district might be harder for him. He would live in a district that would essentially go very far east, and it could be much more competitive. He told me that he has not ruled out running in another district besides the one he lives in. Legislators are not allowed to do that. They have to run in the district they live in. But in Congress, members can run in basically any district.
Before we let you go, Nicole, what are the next steps in redistricting?
Yeah, I believe the commission very late last night finalized their assembly maps. They will begin working on their congressional maps now, really fine-tuning those, getting them in a place they want to be. And they'll vote on those to, you know, they'll continue to take public feedback. They will finalize these maps just before Christmas and send them to the Secretary of State to be certified, I believe, the 27th.
Yep. Momentum is just going to pick up. Thanks, Nicole.
It's coming right up. Thank you so much.
That is CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon discussing Republican Congressman Devin Nunes' retirement at the end of the year, heading to run former President Trump's new social media company. Up next, the UC Davis Genome Center joins us about their lab's role in helping the state track and identify COVID-19 variants. Plus, CAP Radio's Donna Appadoni shares her conversation with former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs about his new memoir, The Deeper the Roots. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Last winter, California endured a massive COVID-19 surge. That was, of course, before vaccines were approved and widely available for the public. As of today, roughly 77% of eligible Californians have received at least one dose. But state officials are still preparing for the possibility of a winter surge, especially as new variants continue to pose a threat. That's where UC Davis Genome Center comes in. Scientists at the center have been working diligently for more than a year, running more than 1 million COVID tests, genetically mapping the virus to know which variants are spreading and where. Joining us this morning is Charlotte Archeria, a research assistant with the center, to talk about how they're helping the state with this mission. Charlotte, welcome to Insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start off by telling us what the Genome Center does and how it's actually specifically helping the state track and identify COVID variants like Omicron and Delta?
Yeah. So we actually start off by doing what I call the primary test. So a COVID-19 test, saliva test for UC Davis and the community. And that allows us to have access to a good sampling of the community's COVID cases. So the primary test is a saliva test. We were able to do 1 million tests by tapping into some of the high throughput technology from the agricultural sector, which lets us do a lot of qPCR. And so once we have the positive test, we can take those samples and look for the mutations that define these variants. So the CDC and WHO decide which variety of COVID is of concern, right? We have a lot of different ones.
Yeah, there's like hundreds or thousands of variants, but there's, you know, several, a little less than a dozen that are of concern. And I think the prominent one, especially in the United States, is Delta currently.
That is correct. That is Delta. But we take a look at 11 places in the genome and see if there's a mutation or not. And then that pattern of mutation versus not mutated sites tells us which variant it is. And we look for all the variants that CDC has identified.
Yeah, I can only imagine how busy y'all have been in the last, 20 months or so. I'm just curious, what did the center do prior to the pandemic?
So actually, a lot of the staff working on COVID came from different labs. We do have some dedicated clinical lab scientists that help us with the human side, the And we have many more that have come over either from sequencing technology. I came from actually monitoring variants of a lettuce pathogen. So I'm used to monitoring variants, but not for humans.
Well, and that brings me to my next question. This is just so interesting. I mean, part of the success behind your testing program is rooted in agricultural genetic technology, and you yourself specialize in agricultural research. How are agricultural scientists and their tools able to step into the role of human viruses and kind of like human virus detectives so easily?
Well, because genetics is kind of genetics. We're used to looking at sequences of DNA, or in this case, RNA, and tracking if there are mutations or not. So agricultural scientists screen either their plants or the pathogens for mutations and watch how it changes in reaction to new varietal releases. And it's the same. It's the same biology.
What's the biggest challenge, then, that you and your colleagues face when it comes to identifying and tracking variants?
I think the challenge is really keeping up with the speed of the changes and the speed that these variants move. That's where genotyping is really an advantage. So once we know what mutations are present in a variant of concern, we can just assay for those. We can look for those mutations and then get results in a couple of days and pass those results on to the county in real time, unlike sequencing, which has its advantages in other respects. But we're lucky because genotyping is a lot faster. So we can tell our county health officer when we see something within days, not weeks.
And given that you've surpassed 1 million COVID tests, Davis is obviously in Yolo County. Where are you collecting these samples? Is it just within the immediate area, for example, Davis, or does it go further than that?
So we started with UC Davis, and then we started collaborating or a partnership with Healthy Yolo Together. And as our capacity at the Genome Center has increased, we've increased our spread. So it started with the Davis community. Now we're at Yolo level, especially in the schools. And we do get some positive samples from neighboring counties just for genotyping, not for testing.
Given that this is your wheelhouse, I mean, in the beginning of Focus with Agriculture, what has surprised you most in this journey?
I have to say, pathogens are always surprising. I always am amazed at how much variation they can create.
Obviously, Omicron is dominating the news cycle in the last week or two. Delta, however, is currently responsible for like 99% of the cases in the country. What can your lab tell us about the spread of Delta in our region and what you're monitoring as we head deeper into the winter months?
So Delta came into our region and became dominant in our region in late July, August. And like you said, most of the samples that I get are Delta. And it's just that's continuing to dominate the trends, right?
Are you operating under the assumption that Omicron is here and spreading throughout our area?
That's correct. I mean, we see more and more news stories about people having Omicron that did not internationally travel. So it's obvious that it's here and it's just a matter of time.
Given that this is a new variant of concern, does that ultimately increase the demand for your center again?
Yes. So the demand for just COVID testing is independent of Omicron. But the demand for genotyping has increased. We're hoping to get some counties back that were interested before Delta. They were sending us samples. But then when Delta was dominant, they didn't care so much. Everybody knows they have Delta.
Oh, before we let you go, Charlotte, I mean, given that we're going into the holidays, the winter months, is it still too early to forecast how any of these variants are going to spread and impact our region?
I think it's definitely too early to tell the impacts. I don't think we know what Omicron is going to look like. I do think we will see some spread of Omicron.
Yeah, pretty consistent with what we've been going through for nearly 2 years now.
Yeah.
But we have vaccines and they're widely available.
Yes, vaccines are going to help.
Thank you so much, Charlotte.
No problem. Thanks.
Charlotte Archeria is with the UC Davis Genome Center and explaining how she and other scientists are helping the state identify and track COVID-19 variants. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs was the first Black mayor of Stockton. He was also the youngest mayor to serve a city of more than 100,000 people when he was elected at 26 years old. Many eyes were on him, including an HBO documentary, especially as he created the nation's first universal basic income program, which many cities throughout the nation are trying to implement now. After losing his re-election bid in 2020, Tubbs moved on to work with California Governor Gavin Newsom as a special advisor for economic mobility and opportunity. Tubbs was in the process of writing his memoir back in 2020, and it was released last month. CAP Radio's Donna Appadoni spoke with him about the memoir and brought us that conversation last week. All right, I want to just start right off with the title of this book. Where did he come up with the title, The Deeper the Roots?
Well, when I first heard the title, I thought, oh, well, this is just Michael Tubbs talking about how much he loves his hometown, Stockton, and how much his family influenced his life. But, you know, if you know Michael Tubbs at all, you realize that that title came from his musical hero.
The Deeper the Roots came from a lyric in a Tupac song called Keep Your Head Up. Tupac's a big inspiration of mine, hip hop music writ large. And I knew I wanted to make sure I had a title that kind of spoke to that. And also I think The Deeper the Roots is this beautiful imagery around sort of being really grounded in a place that you can grow. And I think I've been so blessed to be grounded in a place like Stockton with my mom, my aunt, and my grandmother. And that's given me deep roots with which I hope to grow and expand and continue to make an impact.
And I have to repeat about those three women, Michael's mother, his grandmother, and his aunt, who all worked together to raise him. He refers to them as his three moms. It sounds like they were very clear with him and very strict, but they were also very encouraging.
Yeah. And you asked Michael about imposter syndrome, and this is a conversation I've actually had with a lot of friends of mine, which is just this feeling of inadequacy or not belonging despite one's qualifications. And studies have shown people of color, especially women of color, experience it at higher rates than others. What did Michael tell you about his experience with imposter syndrome?
Well, yeah, a lot of us have felt this at one time or another. We feel like maybe we understand the meaning of what Michael Tubbs is talking about here. And it does, as you said, play a larger role in people of color. There's also often this big, loud message that you can't be better, you're never going to go anywhere, and that sinks in after a while. So with someone like Michael, when he accomplished something, I mean, he went to Stanford, he had a White House internship, elected as mayor of Stockton at age 26, it doesn't matter how big the accomplishment is, there's still that feeling of, wow, I hope I can do this. And as Michael explains, there's also a sense of responsibility.
Yeah, I think sort of this Claude Steele was a professor of mine at Stanford, and he did amazing research around this idea of stereotype threat and this idea of imposter syndrome. It really speaks to how even when fighting against bias, even with rejecting bias, if you're in a society that tells you certain messages about who you are because of where you're from or what you look like, etc., that those you could begin to internalize those messages, or you have a nagging question about whether those things are true, which kind of impedes on ability. So, I mean, you mentioned it in the bio, but being the first isn't necessarily fun. It's actually a little bit scary. Being the only, being the youngest all the time, the stakes are high, because you realize you don't represent just yourself. You represent everyone who looks like you. You represent everyone who shares characteristics with you. and other people may not get a chance based off your performance. So I think it's that pressure that I talk a little about in the book, and also this idea of survivor's guilt, this idea that I felt guilty because I had come from poverty, but I was successful. I felt guilty that because I did come from Stockton, but I am comfortable in social circles at Stanford, and sort of navigating that survivor's guilt. And it actually wasn't until I became mayor where the imposter syndrome, I realized, just had no useful function.
And that statement right at the end, I think, says so much about who Michael Tubbs is, that he reached a point where imposter syndrome was just not useful.
Right. Feelings are not facts.
Right.
And that really paved the way for his leadership style. What does he say about leadership? What does that mean to him?
I had to ask him about that in a couple of different ways. Obviously, when you reach the level of being elected mayor of a significant size city and you're still in your mid-20s, leadership and vision are a big part of who you are, a big part of your character. And that certainly is true of Michael Tubbs. But I also realize that not everybody has his skills in listening at any age. So I had to ask him about that. You mentioned that you recognize that a good leader knows what to do because the constituents tell you what to do. Why is that such a rare thing in politicians?
Yeah, I think it's a rare thing in politicians because your time is so divided. And sort of what your constituents and voters can mean the same thing, but they can mean different things. So when I was mayor, I listened to everyone. But I even listened to those who didn't have political power, who were still my constituents. I listened to those on the margins. I listened to those who are poor. I listened to the formerly incarcerated, had them sort of help inform priorities and help inform how to move the city forward. And oftentimes in politics, the easiest thing to do is listen to voters and donors. listen to special interests. Listen to the police union president. Listen to the fire union president. Listen to the big developer in town and have that drive your agenda. I mean, they were part of the conversation, but they definitely didn't have a monopoly in terms of my time or my decision-making, which led to some tension, but I think also led to a lot of policies that cities around this country are emulating and copying today.
So I know the constituents you talk to would know the right questions and would know the problems that you would have to solve in the positions you held. But do they also have their own answers?
Sometimes. And I think that's a balance. I think sometimes folks really had answers. I think in the book I talked about how my first meeting with a community group, they were like, close down this liquor store. Very clear problem, very clear solution. And it made sense that we were able to do it. But I think oftentimes, particularly in this moment where everyone's information source isn't necessarily true or accurate, where disinformation is running rampant. I mean, there's some constituents today who say the solution to getting rid of COVID is to not get vaccinated. I remember being mayor and having constituents come and articulate solutions born out of misinformation and saying that we don't need a mask ordinance in San Joaquin County, that how dare I put a mask ordinance in front of people in Stockton. So I think as a leader, you have to also be able to filter and to read between the lines and understand that everyone who's speaking isn't speaking from a place of knowledge or understanding, that oftentimes people speaking are from fear or from disinformation, and you hear, but you have to make the decision that's actually going to move the community forward. And sometimes that's popular and sometimes it's not.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio's Morning Edition host, Donna Appadoni, about her conversation with Michael Tubbs and his new memoir, The Deeper the Roots. As we all know, Michael Tubbs lost his bid for re-election to Stockton Mayor Kevin Lincoln, currently the mayor. What I remember from that specific race back in 2020 was that Michael Tubbs led Kevin Lincoln in the primary nearly twofold, 41% to 21%. 8 months later, lost to Kevin Lincoln, 56 to 43%. Did you talk to him about losing that re-election?
Yeah, it was just a year ago, a little over a year ago. A lot of people thought that he would win because of the early situation there with the primary. A lot of people were surprised that he didn't. So, of course, I had to ask him if he was surprised.
Yeah, I think my opponent was surprised that he won. to be frank, just from conversations we had off record during the campaign, when he would express inspiration or appreciation for my leadership and saying, so I think it was a huge shock, particularly because I'm someone who I studied. So I'm like, okay, to be mayor, you need to cut crime, check. You need to bring money in, check. You need to change the perception of the city, check. You need to have endorsements, check. Like I did everything you're supposed to do. So that was the biggest surprise. But I realize now that I really underestimated just the power of disinformation, that while getting scholarships, doing basic income, reducing gun violence, folks spent 4 years just lying and creating a narrative that just wasn't true, but it felt real to people. It really played on people's biases. You mentioned sort of in the intro being the first Black mayor. It's not because no other Black people ever were qualified to be mayor of Stockton, but because, I mean, there's institutional racism and latent racism in the community that has to be addressed. And I think they're able to prey on that, prey on fears, prey on civic illiteracy. I love my city, but it's the least educated city in the country. So the most susceptible to sensationalism, to lies, to conspiracies, that the mayor is under FBI investigation, that the mayor is stealing millions of dollars to live in a $500,000 home, that the mayor is just bizarre. But to this day, and that's what's heartbreaking, people believe those things.
And despite that detour, Michael Tubbs is continuing to work to help those who live in poverty as a special advisor for economic mobility and opportunity for Governor Gavin Newsom. Did you talk with him about that or this next chapter that he's embarking on?
Yeah, then not much slows this guy down, that's for sure. This is an enormous goal that he's talking about doing. It's similar to the work that he started in Stockton, but now working on a statewide scale. And he points out, it's really crazy that a state as wealthy as California has so many people living in poverty.
I am starting an effort called Ending Poverty in California to really think of all the assets we have in California in terms of entertainment, culture, influencers, people like those of us listening here, politicians, Democrats in the House, Democrats in the Senate, Democrats in the Governor's Mansion, and really grapple with the fact that despite these assets, we lead the nation in poverty. Despite these assets, people can't afford to live here. And how do we summon the will to really address this? Because as California goes, so goes the nation. So it's called Ending Poverty in California, or EPIC. And it will be sort of an initiative that will go for the next couple of years and really getting all of us excited about the idea that, A, we should end poverty, but we can. Like, we have the power to, like, it's in our grasp if we want to, and then doing what we have to do it. So, I mean, big goal, audacious goal, but it's not big, it's not audacious, why do it, right?
You've done big and audacious before, so you know what to do. Yeah. How much has poverty grown in the last 10 years in California? How is it measured, and how do you know if it's going up or down?
Well, I just spoke with the governor not too long ago, and he mentioned that because of Golden State stimulus, because of child tax credits, because of stimulus checks, poverty actually went down this year, 25%, which is huge. And we know under the leadership of Assemblymember Burke and the End Child Poverty Now Coalition that before the pandemic, work was being done to eliminate deep poverty for children. They moved 2 million people. Children out of poverty in California. So there's a lot of debate about how do we measure poverty, because some say, and my response to that is that the methods we have now are imperfect and are probably too low. But even with such a low bar for poverty, still too many people in it, right? So even if we change the measure and it's more people, it doesn't change the fact that we have an issue with poverty that would lead the nation in poverty and that it's within our grasp.
So that leads me to the universal basic income pilot that Michael Tubbs spearheaded in Stockton when he was mayor. 125 randomly selected residents, $500 per month, 24 months, no strings attached. The preliminary findings were widely reported on earlier this year. How is this shaping the work he's doing now?
Well, universal basic income certainly is something that Michael Tubbs is famous for, no doubt about that. The intention behind it is to ease some of the incredible stress that comes with poverty. And once people feel a little bit less stress and they can focus their attention on their family, and that ends well for everybody. Cities and towns all over the country are contacting Michael Tubbs, trying to model this concept of universal basic income. And he's answering their questions as well as he can. And that the same concept is part of this plan for the statewide Ending Poverty in California EPIC project.
If we give a guaranteed income, a check to everyone with children, huge win for this country. It's not all the way there, but it's huge. It would be the most significant piece of domestic anti-poverty legislation since the New Deal, if not even bigger than that. So I think and we're almost there. So I think that's a huge first step. I think that in California, there's been a lot of energy around foster youth who are transitioning from foster care to adulthood, which makes sense to me. There's been energy. Senator Cortese has been leading on that. Senator Skinner has been leading on sort of pregnant women, particularly Black pregnant women, and sort of providing guaranteed income with the Abundant Birth Project in San Francisco as a model to help with maternal health outcomes. But I also think the stimulus checks make a lot of sense. Let's start with everyone making $75,000 and below. You won't get to everybody, but you will get to everyone who needs it, which I think is important. If we want to go bigger, we could go bigger, but 75K or below, or the Golden State stimulus checks, 50K or below, I'm good with those as starting points because I know that that will make an immediate impact on the issue I care about, which is poverty.
And as you pointed to, Donna, that legacy is still picking up momentum across the state and even nationally. The state is funding future pilot guaranteed income projects. Multiple Bay Area cities and counties have already launched universal basic income programs following Stockton's. Circling back to Michael Tubbs' memoir, what did you find most impressive about The Deeper the Roots?
There were three things that impressed me. Love and education and determination. He really let the love from his three moms guide him throughout his life and still does. He made education a priority for himself. And then there's his determination. He wants to make sure that he can use education to bring a lot of people out of poverty. Those three things.
Donna, thank you so much.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And that is my conversation with Cap Radio's Morning Edition host, Donna Appadoni, about former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs' new memoir, The Deeper the Roots. Still ahead, on the 80th year remembering the Pearl Harbor attack, a family in Amador County is receiving long overdue closure. DNA testing positively identifying the late Navy sailor. We'll speak with his niece. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today marks 80 years since Pearl Harbor. The surprise attack killed more than 2,300 troops and thrust the U.S. into World War II. In the years since, the Pearl Harbor Project worked to identify hundreds of unidentified service members aboard the USS Oklahoma. And on this 80th year, all but 33 of the nearly 400 unidentified sailors have been individually identified. In Amador County, one family is receiving long overdue closure. Leslie Dulles was killed on that fateful morning, 21 years old at the time. Thanks to DNA testing, Dulles has not only been identified, but his body returned to loved ones and laid to rest in Amador County. Peggy Gardner is the niece who received that call about her late uncle, who was actually the identical twin brother of her father, Lester Dulles. Peggy and I have been chatting about this journey, and she joins us now about this long overdue closure. Peggy? Oh, I think we lost Peggy. We're going to take a brief music intermission, get Peggy back on the phone, and we'll bring you that conversation. All right, we are back. Peggy, are you there?
I am.
Hello, Peggy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. It was kind of difficult, but here I am.
Yes. Well, I am very happy that you are here. And talking to us about your uncle, Leslie Dulles, what did you know about him growing up with your father?
Well, I knew that mostly it was shrouded in emotion. My dad didn't talk too much about the details. You know, every time December the 7th, like today, would roll around, it'd get pretty heavy. There would always be something on the TV, even back when it was black and white. And it was like, oh, boy, his tears would just roll down his face. And he really wouldn't talk too much about it. So what I knew was that it was his identical brother. They looked exactly alike. Their names were almost exactly alike. And they had spent their entire life together with the exception of 3 days. And that was 3 days prior to December 7th, 1941.
Wow. So your father, Lester, was also in the Navy as well. Where was he that day?
They enlisted together in 1940, were assigned to the USS Oklahoma. And here's two farm boys from the middle of Illinois going to Hawaii. I mean, what an adventure. And they were there for a year because the USS Oklahoma docked there December 6th of 1940. So the ship was there for one whole year. But 3 days before, or maybe a few days prior to that, my dad was reassigned for some different training, and he left on a different ship to go back to the mainland for that training.
Wow. And obviously this is 80 years ago, communication technology very different. How did your father and their parents find out about Leslie?
Well, my dad knew first. That can't be true because President Roosevelt went on the air and talked about the Day of Infamy. So everyone in the nation knew immediately what had happened. My dad's ship was told immediately to turn around and come back to Pearl because there had been an attack. Whatever ship he was on, turned around, came back, but they had no idea about the scope and the range of all the, you know, devastation that had taken place. So when they came into Pearl Harbor, I know this much, all the shipmates were just devastated to see what had happened. My grandparents, it took a long time back then, I'm sure, to find the ship's roster, and I know the Navy attempted to go down and free some of the sailors who were trapped in the overturned, capsized hull, and they did get, I think, 32 they were able to save through the holes in the hull. So it took a while for my grandparents to receive notice that my dad had been killed.
Oh, right, because they enlisted at the same time, so they're identical twins.
And their numbers, their service numbers, were just one digit apart. And then, sometime later, they got notice that both the twins had been killed. And then my dad was able to, telegraph them. I guess that's how they must have done it then, that he was alive. So then they knew that it was, you know, Leslie who had perished on the USS Oklahoma.
Wow, just how tumultuous and tragic all of that is.
Yeah.
80 years later, how did you find out, or when did you receive the call that your uncle had been positively identified?
In February, I got a call of this year. I got a call from a person who said they were a genealogist, and they were attempting to find, you know, individuals. And right away, you know, my defenses went up. It's like, oh, this doesn't sound, what are you talking about? So then she talked further and said she was contracting with the U.S. Navy to find the oldest living relatives of Leslie Philip Dulles. Well, okay. So I kept talking to her, and she knew things that, you know, other people would not have known. So I thought, oh, okay. And it was like, wow, they what? And it was just like a thunderbolt. What do you mean? They've identified my uncle, and they now want to bring him home. It was just amazing. It was just almost supernatural.
And what happened since then? I know that you actually had a service in Amador County for your uncle.
Yes. So starting in February, there was a lot of communication with the Navy. They have a wonderful group of folks that's what they do, is to research, identify, and attempt to return fallen soldiers in any war since World War II, because anybody before that, probably there is no DNA evidence of living relatives, and, you know, return them to their families. So there was lots of, you know, Navy officers that I talked to about the details, and I found out lots of information I didn't know about the actual attack and where the bodies were and what happened to them. And anyway, through the Navy, I mean, it's just they were wonderful, and they returned him to us in October.
It was a wonderful ceremony when I watched it, and you could really see how much Leslie Dulles and really what happened in Pearl Harbor still resonates with your neighbors and the community.
Yeah, it was really special. It was really special to me. I mean, I never knew my uncle. I was born after he died, but, you know, he felt like a part of our family, that big hole that was missing. And I know I have a lot of great, you know, neighbors and people that, you know, that I know in this community. I've lived here pretty long. And just living in a small community like Amador County, it's just the community here is so supportive and caring, and they just come out, you know. And for a lot of people, I think the December 7th resonates because it was a time when the entire nation pretty much came together and, you know, saw a goal that they needed to attain, and they gave it all and they went after it. And that's, you know, a big part of being an American.
Yeah. Leslie and Lester, your father and uncle, would be 101 years old today. How do you think your father would feel if he were alive today to find out that his identical twins' brothers' remains have been positively identified 80 years later?
Well, he'd feel a range of emotions, but he would be just so grateful. He would be happy. He would be relieved of the guilt that he felt because he wasn't there at the last moments of my uncle's life. He would feel it's hard to know, but I think he would just feel all those things plus more. I mean, this was his second self that he lost, and yeah, it would be a full circle kind of a event.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing, and I'm just really happy that you received some closure, I mean, decades later.
Yes, me too. It's been a wonderful thing. I've never been to a naval ceremony like that, but oh my, what a moving ceremony. It was really something.
I could feel it watching it from my laptop, so yeah, I could only imagine being there.
Yeah, it was out in the cow pasture, too. That was pretty nice.
Beautiful. That is Peggy Gardner, the niece of the late service member Leslie Dulles, who served in the Navy and was killed in Pearl Harbor. His remains were positively identified earlier this year and was laid to rest in Amador County, marking the 80th year of the attack. That's it for Insight today. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.